Hi, this is the Chunky Podcast. We're back for a second week. We did it.
Yay.
And we're here to talk about a couple of Sofia Coppola's films and what they mean to the zeitgeist. So, Again, I'm Mitchell Cravens.
And I'm Francesco Pascuzzi.
I am a web development programmer who doubles as... I was trying to be really formal about it, but I don't even know what to say now. I was literally about to say societal critic. Basically, I have a lot of interests. One of them is film, and Francesco is my best friend, and he has really kindled that interest in film. So yes. I will let him get into his background really quick.
I teach and write about film, and I watch a lot of movies. It's my favorite thing to do other than talk to Mitch about them.
Or to talk to Mitch about anything, right?
Yeah, really, but yes.
Yeah, same here. So let's talk about why we chose to do these this week. I mean, there's the obvious thing that The Beguiled is in theaters right now.
Yes.
So that was an easy start.
Yes.
The second thing, which is most obvious to me, is that there's been some controversy around The Beguiled. I mean, there's controversy around Sofia Coppola, period. But there's a significant whitewashing narrative that occurs in The Beguiled from its adaptation from a book into a film and just generally.
Yes.
So obviously that's of societal interest. But we thought it would be interesting to get more into what's problematic about Sofia Coppola more generally.
Well, so, I mean, the interest in the film is clearly because it's out now. It's going to be probably an Oscar contender. And it's pretty much, I think the biggest release right now out in theaters in terms of like stuff coming out of Cannes. Why I want to do the podcast is just to have a chance to talk about how these Coppola movies are kind of interacting with their setting of choice, and in particular, what is problematic in selecting a specific setting to tell a specific story, and then choosing what stays in and what's left out, or in general, what's problematic about appropriating a different culture, a different country as a setting, and then not really knowing how to unpack it in a meaningful / respectful way.
Right, and I think it's a really important thing when it comes to Coppola's films. So I'm not gonna act like I'm an expert in her films. I'm almost positive I've only seen Lost in Translation and The Beguiled, which we'll get into today. But I think that as a casual fan and as someone who appreciates cinema, it's easy to, I think, get lost in Coppola's landscapes and her characters, because I would say that she does well on both those fronts. And I would say that from a pure filmmaking standpoint, she does a lot of stuff right, and she's a good director, but there's a certain colorblindness and a degree of white feminism that comes with her films that is kind of
difficult. That's worth talking about, in terms of good intentions and how they don't quite seem to pan out for her. The point of the podcast is not to argue that she's a racist. It's just to argue that her films get some things right, and then the things that go wrong go really wrong. Yeah.
All right, so do you want to get into... So we wrote an outline for this podcast.
Yes.
We're going to try to keep it to close to 45 minutes. I think we did that last time anyway, but but we're basically going to do sort of a four-part thing for each film, and then we'll compare the two.
Yeah.
And we're going to start with a plot summary of The Beguiled.
Yes.
Do you want me to do that, or do you want to?
I can do it. So the movie takes place during the American Civil War, right? So it's probably what, 1865, something like that. It takes place in Southern America, I think in Virginia, right?
Yes.
This Farnsworth School, which is basically a girls' school, with, I think, five or six girls left. Nicole Kidman plays Miss Martha, who's this leading presence in the school. And I think we're at the tail end of the war, right? So like the teachers, the students, and the slaves have left, and the slaves have really left because you never see
and are nowhere to be found. Did they go to the north? Where are they?
There's like no black people in this film, not even in the distance.
Not even a mention of a black person. Yes.
So one morning, one of the girls, and I want to need to look up names, but I think so. Amy is her name. She's one of the students. She finds this, corporal of like the Union Army. His name is John. I don't remember the last name. So he's fled the battlefield, right? And she finds
he was wounded. He got wounded, and then he fled.
Yeah. Yes, he fled because he was wounded. So she takes him back to the school, and I guess all the women decide that they will take care of him and nurse him back to health, and then turn him in. And he's very badly wounded. He has his leg is really banged up. So the first few days is kind of touch and go, right? We don't know whether he's going to live or not. But then he gets better. So I guess they just decide we'll turn him into the Confederates as a prisoner of war. Except that the girls start to show an interest in John, and John picks up on it, and he decides, I guess, to take advantage of the situation. He's basically destitute, right? So to take advantage of the situation and flirt back, and there's a couple of them. One is the Kirsten Dunst character Edwina, and the other one is the Elle Fanning character, and her name is Alicia, who kind of very openly start flirting with him, and he understands that if I can get on their good graces, I probably have a chance to actually stay, and I don't have to deal with the Confederate Army, and I'll be fine.
And maybe I'll get to have sex.
And maybe, yes, plus spoilers. Maybe I'm going to get laid. So this kind of love, or I guess attraction triangle between John and Edwina and Alicia, I guess it all comes to a head one night where, this is probably where I should say slight spoiler alert. There's an indiscretion regarding John and Alicia and Edwina, who had, kind of openly told John that she loved him, and John in return had said that he was in love with her and wanted to marry her. She obviously, this doesn't really sit well with her. And this kind of, it's the start of a chain of events that I think dramatically kind of alters the tone of the film. And I think maybe with the plot, we should stop here because it's hard to give anything else up without like getting into major spoilers.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, when you were about to say who he has sex with, I was talking on mute for like 20 seconds. I didn't realize. I literally was like, spoiler.
Did I say too much?
No, I don't think so.
I said indiscretion. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just ruined it for most people. Don't worry.
Okay, good, good. We'll put spoiler alert on the kind of spoiler alert in the description. So yes, this is a setup for then, I guess, the denouement of the film. In terms of, I guess, the reception of the film, the reception has been, I'd say, not overwhelmingly, but generally positive. The film premiere in Cannes last month, maybe a little longer than that, a couple months ago, Nicole Kidman was in Cannes representing this film and I think three more projects, and she got an award just for that, which is fine because she should get all the awards. She's
all wonderful. The awards.
Yes. But
except
I think
for, except for accents, except for doing a Southern accent,
the accents were, they're not her strongest suit, but she's still amazing. Yeah.
She was good. She was really good.
Yeah. The meaningful, I guess, the significant thing about its Cannes kind of showing is that Sofia Coppola won the Best Director award, which is, has gone to a female now only twice in the history of the entire festival. So it's not something that happens a lot. And,
who was the other woman that won it, by the way?
That's a good question. Let me look it up.
Tu dois faire le Google.
I'm not sure if this was the Oscars.
I know. It's not. I almost said it's not relevant. It's very relevant, but like,
no, I'm not.
I was wondering if you knew off the top of your head, because
I kind of want to say. I thought it was Jane Campion, but it's not. Hold on. Does it say
the listeners are boring? They're boring. They're bored. Listeners, you're boring.
There's a lot of good names in here.
They're going on to another film podcast.
Okay, well, she is the second woman to win the award. We'll have the other name for our next podcast. I don't know off the top of my head.
The next podcast will be 5 seconds, and it'll just be
it is Yulia Solontseva, who won the Best Director Award in 1961 for The Story of the Flaming Years.
Have you seen that film?
I have not.
Have you heard of that film?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Well, Yulia, if you're listening,
very
proud of you.
Yulia is long gone, but yes.
If you're listening from beyond the pale,
yes.
We're still happy for you.
But yeah, so it's, I guess, a significant feat in so far as, I guess it's an award that's dominated by usually white guys. So it's important that this happened, and it's great that it happened. We can talk about whether we think she deserved it or not, but it is pretty significant. And I think it's kind of like, you know, representative of the fact that the movie is doing well with critics, and she is realistically a possible candidate for best director. It would be her second nomination. So, yeah. The general.
Hopefully after a Moonlight Oscar win, that doesn't happen in that future, but I would not be surprised. It's the Academy. So,
you never know. The other thing of notice in terms of the reception has been all the think pieces about the whitewashing aspect in the film. It isn't the first time that Coppola has had to deal with accusation of, I guess, let's say, cultural insensitivity. That's, I guess, what that's going to work as a bridge when we get into Lost in Translation. But the issue here is that this, and we kind of hinted at it, this is a film that takes place during the Civil War. And there are, it's not just that there aren't any black characters. It's the fact that this is based on a novel and the black characters were taken out of the novel entirely, out of the film entirely, working off of the novel. There's one of the protagonists was actually a slave character. In the 1971 version, I think it's the character of Hattie, which is just, it doesn't exist in the universe of the 2017 version of The Beguiled. And the fact that the character of Edwina, which is played by Kirsten Dunst, was actually a character of mixed race in the novel. And Kirsten Dunst is as white as they come, right? So there was a very concerted effort to cut out all the non-white presence from the film. And when it was brought up to her, she said that, oh gosh, I'm trying to find a way to phrase this in a way that doesn't make her sound bad, but I mean, who cares?
I mean, maybe we should have done some, maybe we should have done some research and just let the quote speak for itself.
I guess, but I mean, she said that she wasn't interested in, I guess, grappling with issues of race, but that she's always been fascinated with the women of the South of the U.S. and that she wanted really the movie to be about this notion of gender struggle and just saying that you're interested in the women of the South sounds like only white women live in the South. So either you're saying that you have no idea of who lives in the South of the U.S.
Slavery was in the North, right? It was only in the Northwest Territories, right?
Right. So she's basically saying, I'm really only interested in talking about white women. And that's all I know how to talk about, which would be a slightly less awful approach to the material. But even then, this is exactly why diversity.
Yeah. It's like if we did a podcast on Super Mario Brothers and focused on Wario.
it's right, just
we're gonna talk about Wario and Waluigi. Yeah.
Luigi. No, I mean, this is exactly why diversity consultants are never hired in Hollywood to assist in movies that deal with non-white characters. It is easier not to have to pay someone to help you out in dealing with some measure of knowledge and sensitivity with a non-white character. And it's just easier to just cut the character out entirely and just say it, you know, who cares? It's not what I want to talk about anyway. So,
I mean, it's a good philosophy for life in general. Like, why be informed when you can be ignorant?
Right. It is very representative, I think, of a certain, there's a certain tendency in the general cultural discourse nowadays that it seems as though I'm not going to concern myself with this. I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist and just continue my,
Hashtag fake news.
Fake news.
That's literally what we're talking about.
They are not fake news. I guess how do you grapple with this issue of whitewashing?
Oh, so me?
Yeah,
or I guess generally. No, yeah, I couldn't tell if it was a rhetorical question or.
It could be a rhetorical question, but I do want to know what you think about it.
I mean, I think it's really important that the think pieces got out there and that people are reading them because honestly, I wonder, even though I'm like, you know, very aware of my own entitlement, Probably not to the extent that I could be, but right. that's another topic. But I kind of wonder if I would have noticed, you know, watching the film, if I had thought about that. I mean, it's one thing, you know, it's one thing to know like something about the book. So like, right. I wouldn't put the onus on the viewer to like go into the movie knowing something about the book. That's not your yes. responsibility necessarily.
Oh yeah, no, they're two separate texts.
But the thing is, like, I feel like I want to give myself the benefit of the doubt and say that at some point I would have been like, they live in a plantation house and there are no slaves.
Okay, thank you. So that was off of what you were saying. It's like, yes, they did, I guess. I guess in terms of cutting characters out, you wouldn't know, right? But at some point, kind of connecting the dots, at some point during the film, I kind of went, okay, so this is taking place during the Civil War, and there are no black people in this movie. No black people in a movie that takes place during the Civil War. No mentions of slavery, other than I think Miss Martha saying at the beginning of the film, oh, the slaves have left. And
she did say that. I thought there was zero mention whatsoever.
I think she does say that, but that's literally one and done. It's like, oh, okay, so we've taken care of that.
Oh, we covered that, yeah.
So that's done. And
all
now,
is right in the Colin, world.
Yeah, Colin Farrell, please get naked. So it's however you spin it, it is just very tone deaf. Also because there is a very palpable fascination with these white, frail, gentle-looking white women that the Coppola has. And having them portrayed as slave owners, which they are in the novel, would have broken the spell of, oh, they're beautiful. It was going to be a little problematic to have, I guess, the audience be as fascinated with these women as she is, if they were also portrayed as slave owners, which they were. So it kind of strikes me as kind of, I don't know, a little convenient that you can just say, I am not equipped to talk about this. It's not the thematic concern that I really want to deal with. So by any reference to the black people, it's like none of this ever happened. It seems a little convenient for me. I get the sense that her main concern was if Nicole Kidman and all these other characters are owning slaves in my movie, then they're not going to be as charming as I think they are or as I want them to be.
Right. Whereas actually, you know, if they actually did it, it would have added another layer of complexity to the characters.
It would have added, I mean,
it would have added. Not to say that's the reason to put it in. It's like, that's not the reason. But right. at the same time, like, that's a fool's way to think about it. Like, yeah.
It would have certainly rang more true to life in terms of who these characters actually were. And the historical circumstances of a movie that otherwise could literally take place in any country at any point in time without any significant alterations to the story that is actually unpacked in the film, right?
Like, they could have been like nuns in Jerusalem in the whatever the thing was during the Crusades.
It could have taken place.
Except maybe there would have been slaves in that one.
Maybe. It could have literally taken place at any point in time in any other country, and it wouldn't have made any difference to the story. So for to take the American Civil War that is so racially charged as an event in history, and then just completely disregard the historical kind of circumstances behind it, it just seems like, well, then what's the point?
But also to do that in 2017, you know, when we're actually, like, you know, for the first time in a while, we're really having significant racial discussions in this country. And what the right wants to do is they want to sort of ignore those discussions and go, you know, like, you have it so much better than you ever had, you know, whatever that whitewashing argument of, you know, I don't know, but it's the same thing, you know, people on the right are trying to erase a conversation about race in today's society, and to be that tone deaf to come out with this film, which whitewashes race at this time. I mean, it's crappy at any time, but to do it now, it just seems like
And from the perspective of an auteur, of a film director, if at any point in dealing with a project you end up in front of a mirror, like telling yourself, I am not equipped to deal with this portion of this story, then you probably should not invest in this project. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's just not the movie for you. Go tell another story that you're 100% equipped to properly grapple with, without making really outrageous cuts that don't make sense.
Yep.
All right.
So I think we got pretty deep into that.
We can move to Lost in Translation, I guess. We sort of touched upon that, and I guess do you want to talk about a little bit about, like, why the connection between the two films, why we decided to do specifically The Beguiled and Lost in Translation?
Well, I think that, you know, we wanted to find a common thread in Coppola's films in terms of being tone deaf to history and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real tone deafness in Lost in Translation about Japanese culture that is, I think, very comparable and significant.
Right. Yeah, so that was kind of the reason why we wanted to talk about these two films together, just because there seems to be this problematic thread linking them kind of in ways that are, I think, worth investigating.
Another thing is that it, you know, and one thing I wanted to say about The Beguiled is that I actually enjoyed the film.
I didn't really say what I thought about it yet, because I think we were going to get into that. I guess we can talk about
it. No, but it's just I want to say is, for the record, before we go forward, you know, we're going to talk about things that are good about the, in terms of filmmaking. I think there's a lot to appreciate in The Beguiled and also in Lost in Translation. They're both films that I enjoyed watching, even if I wanted to cry during Lost in Translation today because it's sad and I was having a bad day. But anyway, so let's move on to Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
Do you want me to do a quick spiel about what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, this movie came out in 2003, so this is... There's no spoilers here, right? Is a movie about an older movie star. His name is Bob
Harris.
Bob Harris, yes, who's played by Bill Murray, who is hired by Suntory Whiskey to shoot a commercial or a series of commercials in Tokyo in Japan. So he travels to Tokyo and he meets Charlotte, who's played by Scarlett Johansson, who just graduated college, and she's kind of left to her own devices because her husband, who's celebrity photographer is super busy, like on
and different self-absorbed.
Yeah, and self-absorbed. Different assignments in Tokyo. So she spends basically most of her stay in Tokyo by herself. And I guess she's also really kind of doubting if her marriage has a future, right?
Well, also, yeah, and self-doubt in that she doesn't really know what to do with her life.
Right, which kind of parallels what Bob kind of is going through.
Yes.
Because he is also
Bob the actor.
Yeah. He's also kind of at a standstill with his career and kind of like caught in this midlife crisis of he's also in a bad marriage, I think, right?
Yeah, it's this midlife crisis of feeling trapped both by his career choices and
by his
marriage and his children.
Yeah. So these two characters form this sort of strong platonic connection, right? At the bar, they meet for the first time at a bar in a hotel, and then the bar seems to be kind of the guidepost that kind of articulates the growth of their relationship, and they get to, I guess, experience life in Tokyo together. They get to talk to each other about their issues and kind of find solace in the fact that they're going through similar issues and struggles, right? Knowing that there's really no future for their relationship, and I guess also not really knowing how to describe what is happening between the two of them, right? There's a connection that could be romantic, but neither one of them, they don't really know how to define or describe what's happening between the two of them. And then the last day the Bob is set to return to the US, they say goodbye. And then later on, as he's headed off to the airport in a cab, he sees her on the street. He gets out of the cab, he goes to embrace her, and he whispers something in her ear, right? And then they kiss and they say goodbye for good. And this is how the film ends. And obviously we don't know what he whispers in her ear. That was the big thing.
Is it actually completely inaudible?
It is completely inaudible.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. So we don't really know what Bob tells her at the end of the film. And I guess to some extent we don't need to know, right? It could be I love you, it could be anything, it doesn't really matter. It's more about what brings the character to that point that I think that really matters in terms of the movie and what the movie is about.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the reception for the film was, I'd say, it's a little early to kind of really gauge how well The Beguiled is going to do, but the reception for Lost in Translation was very, very positive. It got really, really great reviews. It got nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. And I think at that point, Coppola was only the second female nominee at the Oscars for Best Director. The other one being Lena Wertmüller, who's Italian, so of course I remember her. Coppola actually won the Oscar for best screenplay for this film. So, Yeah, the reaction was, I'd say, universally very, very positive. Although, she had to once again defend herself against accusation of racial, cultural insensitivity for the way that Japan is portrayed in the film, which is, I think, what we want to get into, right?
Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit. So the treatment of Japan in the film is, it's sort of this ever enveloping otherness for Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson's characters. They both feel very alone and completely unconnected to what's going on around them, even though there's clearly this extremely vibrant and just always on culture around them. So that's part of it, but more of the problematic part is that it's basically a caricature of Japanese culture. Right. So it doesn't give it any sort of intricacies except for being funny and foreign to white people.
Right.
There's no complex Japanese characters. They all just have this surface aspect of a Japanese stereotype, I think, in terms of how right. white people view Japanese culture. You know, it gets into some of the kind of like overwrought comedy and game shows and the sort of thing that Americans find bizarre in Japanese television.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there are components that I want to believe if this movie were being made now, she would really know better. She couldn't get away with.
Like what, for example? Yeah, go ahead.
The two most problematic things for me are, first of all, the way in which the English spoken by the Japanese characters is used for laughs, basically, right? With the L and R sounds jokes, Bill Murray being very, the character being very kind of condescending and patronizing. It's stuff that today just wouldn't fly. Basically making fun of how foreigners engage and use the language and just play it up for laughs, which is really ridiculous.
Right.
And the other one was really, I guess, in general, this depiction of Japanese life more as a sort of like disconnected series of vignettes, just kind of like a novelty. There's the sex worker that comes off as this completely deranged vignette in the film.
Yeah, this escort that's sent to Bill Murray's room is mm-hmm. basically just a caricature of kinky Japanese porn. You know, she's like, she comes off as completely insane because she's not
a real person, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think, a lot of like kind of novelty kind of components that Westerners have appropriated about Japanese cultures that are just kind of like thrown in a mixer here. And it all comes off as a series of kind of like discombobulated vignettes where he's dealing with work dealing with people that he's unable to communicate with, but not in like a meaningful way, just because he cannot make any effort to actually understand what they're saying in a language that isn't their first language.
And demeans them for using it, in, you know, quote unquote, improperly.
Right. So there's several really condescending jokes at the expense of Japanese characters speaking in English, as though that's fun or laughable. I don't know. And in general, the sense of displacement of these two characters doesn't really come across, I guess, as meaningful as she wanted it to be, because Japan is basically a caricature of itself. So it's like the movie could have taken place on another planet, or Oz, or Jotunheim, whatever. And yeah, because there's really no, I guess, really no humanity to be parsed in any of the interactions that the two characters have with anybody other than each other, because it's like, you're not really.
Right, let me just piggyback off that really quick though. Yeah. And there's no, you know, in the same way that there's very little, humanity in these Japanese characters, it's almost portrayed that they're sort of infringing on, like, Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson's, like, characters' ability to, like, you know, be human and, right, and relate to people.
Right, exactly.
It's almost like the Japanese people are the cause of all their misery, when realistically it's just their lives.
Right. It's like this suggestion that because the movie adopts is really kind of patronizing Westerner, like, point of view, that being human and being Japanese are like two different things. And there's exactly, like, yeah, this sort of like chasm that cannot be bridged between what it is to be a person and what it is to be a Japanese person. And that is the source of the disconnect. And that's very, very unfortunate and problematic that the movie is portraying this entire country in such a dehumanizing way. So,
right, so
yeah, in terms of content comparison, because that's one of the things that we wanted to talk about. I think both films in a way end up presenting characters that kind of live suspended in time and suspended in space, right? Not intentionally, because as I said, there's very little about the Beguile that is anchored to its setting during the Civil War. So this could be a story that takes place anywhere else in the world and any other point in time without really making any difference. And I think the same ends up happening with Lost in Translation, where because Japan is essentially presented as this dehumanized, sort of foreign, unknowable location that's populated by figurines and clowns, it could have been any other setting, made up setting, and the film wouldn't have suffered at all in terms of what it wants to talk about. So there's essentially a case to be made that there's really a disconnect between her stories and the settings that she chooses to then talk about these narratives. And
well, do you think it's more of a focus on, and that it's more of a focus on finding those places that can serve for her as a vacuum into care, it like giving some sort of mise-en-scene, but right, allowing, creating it such that there's only a few environments in which the film can live and the characters can.
Yes. I think that's exactly, that is exactly what she's trying to do. The issue is that the South of the U.S. during the Civil War was not a vacuum. There was a lot going on in terms of,
right, and neither was Japan. In, and
I was gonna say, yes, an entire country that you're clearly kind of culturally completely divorced from. It is not a vacuum that you can just place your characters in not really knowing what it is to live in Japan and then just build a movie on that. These places are not, and the idea of a vacuum, I think, really works. And I'm glad you brought that up, because a vacuum implies an absence of everything, right? Where she is choosing a very dynamic, very complex culture for Lost in Translation, and she's choosing a very problematic, racially charged time in American history for The Beguiled, and then pretending like she doesn't have to deal with that.
Yeah, it's it'd be interesting to hear her talk about. I mean, I'm sure she's talked about it to some extent, but why she chooses the settings that she does for her films.
I think, yeah, and I don't know that that's ever been brought up to her. It seems like she almost does it on purpose. And the same thing happened to some extent with Marie Antoinette, which is not a movie that we were going to talk about in the podcast. But in terms of taking this historical figure and fetishizing this historical figure, kind of in a vacuum. Again, this is a story of this kind of ethereal, pretty girl that's thrown into a situation that is way bigger than she is, and the movie doesn't really have anything to say about the historical circumstances surrounding the character, which is exactly what happens in The Beguiled.
Right, you can have complex characters that are complex because of their own individual stories, but
right,
no real person exists in a vacuum. The way that right. you and I are is because of where we grew up, who we were around, the things that we saw in society.
Right.
So it's a cop out or a Sofia Coppola out to act like, you know, I'm so focused on my characters that I have to ignore everything else. It's unrealistic and it's lazy.
Yeah, and as I said, just as we're saying at the beginning of the podcast, just saying that you're interested in the women of the South, what you're really saying is that you're interested in the white women from the South, which, fine, that's a story you can tell, but you have to be honest about it. You have to
Well, in the same way that she dehumanized the Japanese, it's dehumanizing.
Right.
African American.
Right. It's literally.
It's the same concept. It's just that one side of it is the sort of the antagonist kind of in the film, and the other one is just completely absent.
Right. Because, and we were going to touch upon this, there are good things about both films, right? It's not just a podcast where we're just piling on the two films.
Unfortunately, I'm kind of in a negative mood right now. So I actually have a lot of nice things to say about her talents as a director. But yeah, I don't know how much we'll be getting into that.
I guess what were the two components of The Beguiled and of Lost in Translation that you liked the most? And it could be like something technical. It could be a performance or whatever.
The first thing that comes to mind, I don't think it's my favorite thing, but, mm-hmm. I think my second one would be the filmography, the cinematography. Filmography is not even the right word, cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think that, she does a really good job of closing in her characters through mm-hmm. the lens.
Mm-hmm.
Of doing what she's trying to do, right? Which is creating this type of vacuum, which, like we said, is hard to understand why. But I think that she uses a lot of nice visual devices in both just to create this overwhelming sense of sort of claustrophobia right. in two completely different environments.
That's really good. Yeah.
Beyond mm-hmm. that, I think that she's good at writing plots. Mm-hmm. Plots that aren't overwrought and are original with characters that are flawed mm-hmm. but likable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she does have important things to say about the human experience. You know, I think mm-hmm. that I'm more emotional than usual when the in watching films and in general, mm-hmm. I guess, watching her films than watching a lot of other ones. You know, I wouldn't prefer to go see one of her films, but you know, over something that has a little bit of more high drama or a little bit more variety in terms of staging and,
right.
You know, one thing I will say is, well, I don't know. Yeah. The two films, the acting isn't super strong in either one. That kind of bothered me, but, okay. The dialogue's real good. They're just enjoyable and they're well written and well thought out from a pure film and visually appealing mm-hmm. from a pure film standpoint, but you know, just in the same way that her characters don't exist in a vacuum, a film doesn't exist in a vacuum either.
For me, I would say I liked Nicole Kidman in The Beguiled in terms of what she did with the character. I thought a lot of the character interactions were kind of flat in the way that they were staged and directed. I think when we were preparing the podcast, we were talking about the camera placement for some of the more choral scenes and how some of the, I guess, camera placement choices kind of flattened the action for me. And in general, I found the film a little flat throughout. But within that, I think Nicole Kidman really did the most with her character and with her lines, especially towards the end where it could have gotten really, really campy. Anytime you're Nicole Kidman covered in blood and you have to turn around to the camera and tell someone, bring me the anatomy book. I mean, it could get really, really campy. But I think she created this sort of space for the character where she is always kind of believable in her intentions and motivations, and she's always kind of like tonally together, especially like then the final like dinner scene and everything. She has a couple of lines that are kind of sassy, but she never breaks character in terms of like how we get to know who Miss Martha is and her demeanor and how strict and disciplined she is. I think she did a really good job with that. And I also really like the costumes. In terms of, I guess, the visuals, in terms of the form, it's hard for me to really make a comparison because I found The Beguiled, especially, as I was saying, kind of minimalistic almost to a fault, where I think a lot was lost of what was going on between the characters because of her, I guess, over-reliance on kind of group shots.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Whereas Lost in Translation is all about the back and forth between the two characters and kind of the shot, reverse shot kind of setup that I think is a lot more effective and would have been a lot more effective in this film as well. There were a lot of moments where I found myself thinking I would have like shot this scene in a completely different way, or I would have kind of cut here and maybe inserted a close up or something like that. So whenever that happens to me, it's because I'm not really invested in the film. And I start thinking about, ooh, the costumes are nice, or ooh, I'm paying attention to the score, or oh, look at the blocking for this shot. It's really nice. It's because the story isn't really drawing me in. And then I start kind of paying attention to the more kind of technical aspects of the film.
Yeah, I would say the same for me. Even though I liked it, I would say that I was very focused on the visual aspect, like I always am. I'm really always, it actually doesn't happen very often where I'm so enthralled with the plot of a film that I, you know, just forget, you know, forget that I'm in a movie theater.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I'm like, I train myself to also pay attention to the form and the...
No. I know that. There's a difference between watching a film for a podcast and watching it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have to say, to a certain extent, I think those two things blend together for us. Because
they totally do. Yeah.
We're cinema fans, you know?
Yes. So...
We're cinema fans.
So I guess to some extent... I think the direction in Lost in Translation is a little stronger just because I think she has more of a talent for directing a smaller cast.
Well, don't you think that there could be an argument made for perhaps some of the reason for having so many group shots was that there's sort of a collective mind going on?
Yeah. And I didn't have so much of a problem with, for example, I thought that the prayer sequences were all shot really well, in terms of like the depth of the actual shot.
Those were nice.
Yeah. And the placement of Nicole Kidman in the shot. I was thinking, for example, of, really one of the scenes, the group scenes where, Edwina and John acknowledge each other for like the first time as more than just friends, where Nicole Kidman, her character asks for a moment of silence and everybody is looking down and the two of them, kind of raise their heads almost imperceptibly and kind of acknowledge and nod at each other. And it's done in this kind of like, kind of over the head shot that's like the camera fixed on the characters and just looking down on the characters. And I think that moment is a little lost. I would have wanted her to cut on a close up of the two faces. Maybe for like just a really quick close up of Colin Farrell and Kirsten Dunst, and then cutting back to the group shot, and I think it would have been a little more effective. And it's something that I think I started paying attention to because the story wasn't really drawing me in. So there were all these cues about, oh, this is what's happening. This is how she wants me to read the characters, but I would do this in a completely different way.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm always very focused on visual tricks and cinematography and like,
right,
why certain like colors were chosen or like why. And I think a lot of time I read too much into it. And sometimes you kind of bring me back down to earth. Cause I always want everything to be, you know, meaningful. But in a good film, a lot of the times everything is meaningful and it's a conscious choice.
Yeah. I mean, in film in general, everything has a purpose. And so the fact that the setting in her films basically doesn't have a purpose or has a very problematic purpose is not indicative, I think, of a director that really has it together yet.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I'm very talked out at this point. Yeah. Like I said, I had a really long day. Yeah. So
I feel like we really talked the hell out of both films especially in terms of the things that I wanted to get out more related to culture and I guess cultural insensitivity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to do a quick plug for our blog and our podcast.
Yes.
So this is the Chunky Podcast. I may or may not change the name. Oh, so it's sorry, not the overall name, just the way that it's on iTunes and Google Play. Mm-hmm. So it is on iTunes and Google Play at the moment, right. But it's just under Chunky, and there's another like DJ on there that has a DJ Chunky. Anyway, yeah. It's the one with the black background and the word Chunky on it.
But we don't want to get sued, so we might have to change it to...
I mean, we might have to at some point, yeah. But anyway, so that's up.
And
I made
the website,
a podcast page yeah. on our website, which is www.thevisualtext.com.
Yay.
And there's a blog there. There's an info thing about Mr. Chunky, Francesco.
Yes.
And soon there will be one about me, too,
yes,
I'm sure.
Yes, I was gonna
podcast
say
page with all the episodes. Yeah. And we have a Facebook page. I think it's facebook.com/... Oh, it's for the podcast. Yes. Visual, Chunky _. No, I don't know. Just search
Chunky
podcast. Chunky
podcast.
You'll find it.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm working on reviewing Lost in Translation, The Beguiled. Hopefully by tomorrow, and then reviewing Okja by Bong Joon-ho, which should hopefully be the topic of our next podcast, TBD.
Yes.
Yay.
But which will be dropping next Sunday. We're on a schedule, people.
Oh, yay. Yes. Yes.
So
awesome.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
I made it through the podcast.
Yay. It was good.
And,
it was good.
Yeah, it was. And we will see you next time. Thanks.
Bye.